From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump is threatening on Twitter to close the southern border next week if Mexico doesn't stop illegal immigration. Last night, the president held his first rally since Attorney General William Barr concluded that Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation found no Trump campaign conspiracy with Russians and not enough evidence of obstruction of justice.
The Russia witch hunt was a plan by those who lost the election to try and illegally regain power by framing innocent Americans, many of them. They suffered with an elaborate hoax.
Okay, let's bring in our Friday politics roundtable. Chad Pergram is senior Capitol Hill producer for Fox News. Chad, good to speak with you.
Gentlemen.
And Tolu Olorunupah, White House reporter for The Washington Post. Tolu, good to speak with you.
Good to be here. Thank you.
And let's start with you. What do you make of Trump's messaging and his tone this week? A lot more talk about witch hunts, hints of pardons, criminalizing Democrats. It sounds like he is surely riding a political high.
The president is definitely unleashed this week after he believes he's been vindicated by the Mueller report. Obviously, we have not actually seen the Mueller report, but the four-page summary by Attorney General Barr is something that was well received by the White House. They believe that the president has been cleared, definitely cleared on the issue of collusion with the Russians, and they also believe vindicated on the issue of obstruction of justice because Attorney General Barr basically said that there was not evidence to prosecute a crime of obstruction of justice. So the president is definitely wanting to turn this Russia investigation from a political liability into a political weapon that he can use against his enemies, his perceived enemies, including Democrats, and he believes the media also are his enemies. So he's going to use that to attack reporters and attack the media. So we're going to see this. We saw it last night at the rally. We're going to see this at the president's rallies going forward for the next few months.
Chad, does the president have to be careful, though, because an NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll out today shows 56% of people surveyed feel that questions still exist about whether Trump has been cleared of wrongdoing. 75% say they want the full Mueller report released to the public.
Well, you have to see what is in the report, obviously, and then look at some of the corresponding documentation there. Keep in mind that Robert Mueller had a very narrow path to work on under the current statute. They changed the statute from when Ken Starr was the independent counsel. I think that's an important term. When he looked into President Clinton and Monica Lewinsky and Whitewater back in the 1990s, he had more independence. Mueller had a more narrow scope here. And so, you know, the message from House Democrats to their rank and file this past week has been, we have greater purview in our committees. We can look at other things. They're looking at business dealings. And when you get some of that documentation, both in the Mueller report and corresponding things, to see what, if there was any distance between what Mueller found and the interpretation by Barr, that's going to be key. I mean, the House Speaker Nancy Pelosi indicated that she thought that it was a little bit insulting that they were, you know, having this interpretation set up. She said, we don't need that. We need to actually see the report and then make up our own minds about what's in it. And if you have something that's damning in that report that maybe fell outside of Mueller's purview but is revealing, that could be a problem for the president.
But the question is, are Democrats going to get it? On CNN this morning, House Intelligence Committee member Jim Himes described the options that Democrats are weighing.
One, of course, is to subpoena the entire report, to subpoena Bob Mueller to come talk about the report. Asking a judge to make a judgment on the grand jury information is an option as well.
Tolu, what do you think? Will the public see this report in its entirety?
I think ultimately this report is going to come out. There may be some redactions here and there for classified information, but based on all of the tools that the Democrats have in their toolbox and the fact that they are all united, and even many Republicans are united in saying they want to see this report come out, I do think that they're going to use all the tools in their toolbox, including the courts, including subpoenas, to force the Justice Department to hand over this this full report if they do not do so voluntarily. And we have heard from Attorney General Barr that he does want to release as much of this as possible. At least that's what he said during his confirmation hearing and since then. So there may not be as big of a fight as necessary, but you will see that fight if Democrats don't feel that they're getting what the type of cooperation that they feel that they need from the Justice Department. They will be in the courts. They'll be flying, having subpoenas flying over to the White House and to the Justice Department to get all the information that they think is necessary to understand what Bob Mueller did, and maybe even calling Bob Mueller to testify before the committee to get a better sense of the two-year investigation that he performed.
Chad, anybody who's been paying any attention to the news over the last couple of years knows Adam Schiff. They know what he looks like and what he sounds like. This week, we saw a different kind of Adam Schiff because Republicans have been saying he should resign because he's been pushing the idea of collusion for so long. This was Schiff speaking. He's the chair of the House Intelligence Committee, and he was speaking at a committee hearing this week, saying that there have been a long list of suspicious ties between the Trump campaign and Russians, even after the Barr letter came out. Here he is.
You might say that's all okay. You might say that's just what you need to do to win. But I don't think it's okay. I think it's immoral. I think it's unethical. I think it's unpatriotic. And yes, I think it's corrupt and evidence of collusion.
Chad, what does that tell you about how Democrats are going to respond to what Republicans are saying, which is that Schiff should step down?
Well, both the House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and the Majority Leader Steny Hoyer this week indicated support for Adam Schiff. I spoke with Adam Schiff yesterday, and he thought that Republicans on the committee who were asking for him to step aside were just doing the bidding of the president, who asked him to step aside as chair of the committee. It's natural that the president would attack the lead attack dog by the Democrats in this investigation. I mean, some people might say that, you know, the Mueller report, again, which we haven't seen the full details, but what we know so far— there's a gap there between what Adam Schiff has been saying and what we know so far. He still could be vindicated in all this. We don't know. But that's why Democrats are ready to look at other things and maybe look at business dealings. And that's why they were, frankly, if you got them off to the side and talked to them candidly, excited that the president was stepping on his own applause lines by saying, OK, we're going to attack Obamacare. We're going to try to get it thrown out, something that Republicans have fought for. And it's been disastrous consequences politically for Republicans. They were happy to have that pivot provided for them without really doing much and maybe get away from Adam Schiff and talk about a bread and butter issue which helped them win battleground districts in the midterm elections, health care.
Okay, let's talk about Education Secretary Betsy DeVos, who had a pretty tough week. She spent days defending proposed cuts to funding for the Special Olympics, and here she was in a hearing with Democratic Durbin.
Did you personally approve this, I think a yes or no will do, the $18 million cut of the funding for Special Olympics?
No, I didn't personally get involved in that.
Well, I want to tell you, whoever came up with that idea at OMB gets a Special Olympic gold medal for insensitivity.
Okay, Trump was feeling the pressure because yesterday he overrode that decision, and the Special Olympics now will be funded in that budget. Tolu, what's going on? What do you make of this fight?
Yeah, it's a really head-scratching fight. These presidential budgets are normally just sort of things that Congress takes a look at and decides what the president is interested in, but the Congress normally decides how to spend money. So putting in such a politically toxic decision like this to defund Special Olympics, which is normally gets bipartisan support, is very confusing that the administration decided to do this and that Betsy DeVos, the education secretary, had such a hard time answering and describing why this administration was calling for these cuts. And then President Trump comes out after several days of his education secretary twisting in the wind and just sort of announces that he is no longer in support of this and that he's going to push for funding for the Special Olympics. It's sort of a small sign of the type of chaos that we see in this administration, that we've seen with the president sort of undercutting his cabinet secretaries, going back and forth on different issues.
Also a sign of the importance of the media, frankly, because I guess if something gets enough media attention and bad media attention like this did, the president reverses course.
But these proposals,
right.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Tool.
I was just going to say that's right, that the president said that he learned about it on Thursday, just yesterday, and this is something that was in his budget a month ago.
And in previous budgets,
have been in
too, right?
His
I mean, it wasn't
before.
Exactly right, Chad, right?
Yeah, and keep in mind that, you know, when you put out a budget request, it's just that. Budget requests are not binding. Real ammo in the federal spending world are appropriations. Roy Blunt is the chair of the Appropriations Subcommittee, Republican senator from Missouri. He said he's going to fund the Special Olympics. Congress controls the purse strings in this case. They deal with appropriations. And, you know, there's an old saying that the administration proposes, Congress disposes, and Congress disposed of this proposal pretty quickly to defund the Special Olympics.
And by the way, you mentioned Missouri. I heard this morning that that's where one of the big training centers for the Special Olympics is. So that's personally important to him. One more thing, just in the 30 seconds we have left or so. Chad, let me go to you. Pete Buttigieg, the 37-year-old openly gay combat veteran mayor of South Bend, came in fifth in a national Quinnipiac poll behind Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, Beto O'Rourke, and Kamala Harris. What do you make of that?
Well, he seems to be the flavor right now that's hot. Beto O'Rourke certainly has a long track record, as do Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden. But he's someone who's come onto the scene and commanded attention. The who's up and who's down in the presidential sweepstakes, this is going to change many times between now and next year. And he just happens to be the one who's rising right now.
And I wouldn't want to be up in the polls at this stage, right? I mean, it's way too early. You don't want to peak too
soon. Well, I mean, but they've got to get their donors interested so that they can qualify for the debate. So it matters. We'll keep following all of it. Chad Pergram from Fox News and Tolu Olorunipa at The Washington Post. Thanks to both of you. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you.
40 years ago this week, there was a partial meltdown of one of the nuclear reactors at Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania. It left areas of the facility highly radioactive, but a group of young researchers had an idea to send robots into the damaged reactor to try and repair it. Amy Sisk from member station WESA in Pittsburgh reports that their work helped expand what was then a fledgling field of robotics.
Ooh, boy, look at this.
Red Whitaker calls me over to his computer at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh.
This is really old. I haven't looked at any of it in eternity.
He shows me video footage his robot took of the basement at Three Mile Island's Unit 2 containment building in the 1980s.
They could see for the first time the accumulation of hundreds of thousands of gallons of contaminated water that had filled up like a bathtub to a height of about 8 feet.
The country's worst commercial nuclear accident prompted tens of thousands of people near the reactor to evacuate, fearing radiation exposure if they stayed. In the years following, Mike Pavlik helped oversee cleanup.
We were not going to be able to put human beings in there because of the risk. So we decided that we needed robots to do some of that work.
The thing is, robots had never been used in quite that way before.
It was brand new in the nuclear business. The robots were used primarily in repetitive operations.
Like in auto factories to weld together parts of cars. This is where Whitaker's expertise came in.
I was looking for that opportunity to contribute, and I was looking for that iconic robotic development project that would put the technology on the map.
He enlisted the help of those around him, mainly undergraduate students. John Bears was just a sophomore.
We had a dream and a few pieces of paper and convinced them that we could solve the problem.
Whitaker's younger brother, Chuck, wanted to join the cleanup too. He worked as an engineer for a coal company.
I would come over on the weekends and I would come over on my vacation days and work because it was fun.
In 1983, a crane lowered the first robot into the basement of the Unit 2 containment building. The machine had 6 wheels and special cameras that could withstand radiation, as well as numerous seals to keep out water. A second robot soon followed. It could drill into concrete and remove wall samples for analysis. Bear says their third robot was never used.
We tried to make it a Swiss Army knife that would do all kinds of things.
It could drill and lift items and move them around, but it wasn't reliable. Still, Bear says the engineers learned from their mistakes. Chuck Whitaker walks me through a hallway at Carnegie Mellon University to a timeline showing all the field robots developed here since the Three Mile Island days.
That was the first Mine 1. That was the last thing I built. I was around long enough to, I did all the wiring on this one, worked on some of these other ones. This was the first navigational laboratory. That was our first autonomous driving vehicle.
The Whitakers both work as researchers at CMU today. Bears recently led Uber's autonomous vehicle program in Pittsburgh, and he now heads a robotics company there. The brothers recently developed a robot to help decommission uranium enrichment facilities. Red Whitaker shows me a prototype. It crawls through pipelines in search of residual uranium and sends out sound waves.
It uses that as part of its calculation to determine exactly where it is.
Chuck Whitaker says the robot will save time and money and prevent exposure to humans who would otherwise have to do the work.
And that's really the value, when you can reduce the hazards to the personnel.
That's why the robots went in to Three Mile Island. They assessed the damage and began cleanup. Soon, more robots could go back. TMI is scheduled to close this fall unless the state intervenes. The legislature is considering a bailout for nuclear reactors, as they are struggling to compete against natural gas and renewable power. Robots could be part of the facility's decommissioning. Red Whitaker doesn't know if he would be involved, but...
I gotta say, I would absolutely love to revisit TMI.
To finish a job he helped start nearly four decades ago. For Here and Now, I'm Amy Sisk.
And Amy's story comes to us from State Impact Pennsylvania, which covers Pennsylvania's energy economy. Well, now to the world of video games. The most popular game on the planet with hundreds of millions of users is called Fortnite. It's about, what else? Fighting. And it came out this week with a new update that gamer blogs are buzzing about. The video game industry is now worth $135 billion a year. That's more than the music and movie industries combined. The interesting thing is Fortnite is free to play, but there are revenue streams, and one of them is something called a skin. People pay money to accessorize their characters. And now technology is allowing for a new kind of skin. Ben Brock Johnson covers tech for Here and Now and joins us to talk about that. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Jeremy.
So first of all, explain what these skins are.
Okay, so this is going to sound a little esoteric, but I think the best way that I like to think about skins in the world of digital technology is that they're kind of customizable characteristics. So it's a thin layer that is used to customize everything from when I first learned about skins, like the look of a digital music player on my computer screen back in the day, to the look of your vehicle or a character in a digital space or environment like a video game.
But you're basically putting on a costume to be a character in a video game.
Yes. So like in Fortnite, these outfits include clothing. There are also different versions of the things you use in the game. Like you have these little hang glider like tools that help you move around the map, and everybody gets a pickaxe that they use to harvest resources they can then build forts with, hence Fortnite. But really this idea is used across video games and new games like Fortnite, and there's another new game called Apex Legends that's similar. They sort of use skins really successfully as a way for people and players to buy stuff in the game. Now, Fortnite releases new skins on a sort of regular seasonal schedule. Having the latest styles is, for a lot of players, a way to signal not just your personality in this digital space, tricking out your character, but also your commitment to the game or your level of experience with it. So you're signaling to other players just how big of a fan you are, just like you would in real life with a sports team or something like that. So if your character, for instance, has a new cactus outfit where you're dressed like a cactus, or an inflatable pool toy around your waist, you're sort of showing off. And the more this stuff gets built out and people spend money on it, the more different kinds of options players have to show their personality in the digital world. For instance, you could have a skin that changes your voice or a voice skin because there's a lot of chatting that happens between players while they play games.
Okay, so stand by with that point made, and let's go to our next guest who's here with us in the studio. This is Mike Pappas, who founded a company that makes skins for your voice. It's called Modulate. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
And how does this work exactly?
Well, I have with me a demo app here, so let's give it a try to start. So I'll record something and play it back in a different man's voice. This is a quick test of Modulate.
This is a quick test of Modulate.
So if you'd like to try, you can now record yourself and sound like a woman.
I will say, this is Here and Now from NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
This is Here and Now from NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
Okay.
Not bad.
Yeah. So, and what would you use that for?
So there's a couple reasons you'd want to use voice skins in a game. The first is anonymity. Not many people are actually comfortable using voice chat, which is a core part of many of these games, while revealing their real voice, which is a core part of themselves. Mm-hmm. So just being able to anonymize themselves lets them jump into the game more freely. There's also a lot of opportunities where you're playing as a specific character that has a very unique personality, and you really want to immerse yourself
in
that world
as
that character. Exactly.
And how many voice options are there?
Today, we have something on the order of 100 different voices.
Wow.
It comes from the data that we've used to collect. So we're working on collecting much more data so that we'll be able to go into thousands or even millions of different voices. My co-founder, Carter, has been actually creating a voice skin for himself, which we're all very excited to be using
his own voice.
Using his own voice.
Wow. And does that mean that he has to sit there and record a bunch of phrases, or it just figures out what he would sound like if he were to say a certain thing?
So today he recorded about an hour of his speech so that we were able to learn what he sounds like saying all kinds of different sounds. Moving forward, we'll have so many different voice skins that you'll actually be able to blend them. So you might be able to make a voice skin of me using Carter's plus a few others to find all the characteristics of my own voice. Basically, anywhere that you're using your voice, you can imagine a desire to customize it. Some of the specific applications we've looked at are audiobooks, being able to have a single narrator play the role of all of the different characters. You can also think of call centers, where maybe companies would like everyone at the call center to sound the same, no matter who's picking up the phone, or even further using that to develop the whole voice brand of the company and make sure that they're projecting the image that they want to project.
Or you could watch a cartoon where every character is played. You save so much money. Every character is played by the same actor.
Exactly.
Now, Ben, this caught your eye. Are there a lot of other companies doing stuff like this?
It did catch my eye. You know, I think companies more and more are figuring out how to get in on these microtransactions that generate millions and billions of dollars in the gaming industry. And I think that's really fascinating. This company strikes me as relatively unique in really trying to create audio technology for games like this.
That is Ben Brock Johnson, who covers tech for us at Here and Now, and Mike Pappas, who co-founded Modulate along with Carter Huffman. They're also working with Terry Chen. Thanks to both of you for coming in.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Thank you very much.
And we got some grim environmental news this week. Carbon emissions around the world hit an all-time high in 2018, according to the International Energy Agency. And demand for coal is rising, particularly in Asia, where China is still the world's biggest coal consumer, and it could be for a long time. The report found Chinese coal plants are just 12 years old on average, meaning they're likely to operate for decades to come. Ranping Song is the Developing Country Climate Action Manager for the World Resources Institute, and he joins us now. Ranping, welcome.
Thank you.
And remind us, just how much of the world's coal-fired generation is happening in China?
So there's actually a lot of coal-fired power generation in China. So it's still the largest field in terms of generating power in China. But actually, that trend is going down. So although the latest data is concerning, but we're actually seeing a little bit more hope than it when you just look at the surface.
And why is it going down? Is it because China is turning to renewables?
Actually, it goes beyond that. So it actually goes deeper to the China's determination to change its economy and how the economy works. So in the past, China has relied on industry sectors as the key engine for economic growth. But China wants to shift that gear to a more service sector-driven economy. And that has a big implication in terms of how much energy they need and where those energies need to come from.
Okay. What can you tell us about renewable energy, which grew at a double-digit rate, China ahead of Europe and the United States? What do you make of what China's doing on that front?
Actually, China has been investing very heavily in terms of renewable energy in the past couple of years. We see a very dramatic growth of China's renewable energy sector. And China's investing heavily in terms of also future technologies, not only the current ones, including the batteries and offshore wind. So on one hand, that China is very serious and really taking their opportunities, trying to grow its renewable energies, and the cost has been coming down very dramatically in the past few years.
China is the most populous country in the world, and when you look at it on a per-person basis, are people actually using more energy there than, say, they are in the United States, or is it just a lot on aggregate because so many people live there?
Yeah, of course, not compared to the United States, because in the U.S., we consume a lot of energy on a per capita basis. But then the per capita demand sector is rising. That's just unnatural, right? Because people want to have a better quality of life. On one hand, that we see that the demand is going up very fast.
Because people are getting richer. They want to have an air conditioner or a motorcycle or something like that.
Yeah, as well as people want to go out, they want to travel. So there's a huge demand for transportations and, you know, and energy consumption associated with that.
Okay. Do you believe that the global climate goals around the world to slow greenhouse gas emissions can be met without major changes in China?
Well, I think there's still a really good possibility that China can transition to a low-carbon economy. Actually, the economy is switching gears from a more energy-intensive, carbon-intensive economy to a more low-carbon economy. So we are seeing that there's a bit of struggle between different sectors and different industries. So there's a lot of uncertainty there. But I see there's a huge political will from the top, from the Chinese government. So I'm very hopeful, but it's not certain. It's far from certain.
And to be fair, it's not just China. It was China, along with the U.S. and India, that accounted for 70% of the rise in global energy demand in 2018. Ranping Song of the World Resources Institute, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Let's check in on the flood recovery effort on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. It's been in a state of emergency for over 2 weeks since rapid snowmelt flooded creeks and rivers on the reservation, and some people have been stranded in their homes since the flooding began. This morning, I called into Arlo Ironcloud's popular radio show that broadcasts on Pine Ridge.
Good morning, Peter. You're on the Morning Wakalapi Chit-Chat Show.
Great. Well, thanks so much for having me on. It's an honor. My name is Peter O'Dowd. That's from KILI Radio in Porcupine, South Dakota. And when I was on the air with Arlo Ironcloud, I asked him if anyone on Pine Ridge was still stranded by the floodwaters.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of community members that I know of that just can't go back to their house yet, or they're stuck in their home. There have been people in our community that have been reaching out and taking stuff to them, but for the most part, they just can't get out of their homes right now.
Wow.
They're watered in. We just can't access them.
Well, are they okay?
Yeah, but there have been some a lot of people out there that are struggling because we have dialysis patients, we have relatives that have health complications, and they just can't make it to the proper treatment facility so that they can get the proper care. So,
what are people feeling about the way the state has responded to you? I know a lot of people were wondering why it took the South Dakota governor so long to get some members of the National Guard out there. She says she did it as soon as she was asked, but how are people feeling about whether or not they're being taken care of?
Well, that was the thing, too, because Steve Wilson is the emergency management person for the Ogallala Sioux Tribe, and he had to make the call. He had to actually ask them to come over from the state to bring their water trucks so that certain communities could have at least access to water. I know Christy Noem came down on Saturday last week.
That's
I know
governor.
She came.
Yeah.
She went to a couple communities, but yeah, it's not just Pine Ridge Reservation. It's Rosebud too, and a lot of communities that are on the White River are really suffering from the flooding.
Yeah, we've been hearing a lot of news coverage from places like Nebraska and places like Iowa, not as much here about what's happening on the Pine Ridge Reservation. Do you think that recovery from a big flood like this is different for people who are living on a reservation? I mean, do you face even bigger challenges?
Mostly because we don't have the infrastructure to handle the disaster. Actually, John Reddell just joined me. But last week we were teasing about our snow plows, and we were kind of making fun of our snow plows because we got like some 1960s snow plows out there pushing the snow around, and we just don't have the resources. It's that simple.
I heard you say your co-host John Reddowl is there. John, are you with us?
Can you hear me?
Oh yeah. Hey, how are you, sir?
Good. How are you doing?
Good. I hear the phones ringing in the background. Obviously, this is a big deal for a lot of people. How do you think folks are holding up?
I think we're glad, and we're like really proud of that. So if we survive, you know, I mean, we're used to not having any resources. You know, we're going to get through this. We always do. Do you mind if I give a little plug on where people can find information out?
Sure, please.
Yeah, that's ogallalakotanation.info. You can go there. Go to our social media networks with the Ogallala Sioux Tribe. And those are where you can help with relief for the flooding here on the Pine Ridge Reservation.
Okay. We'll try to link to that on our website as well so that people who hear this in other parts of the country can get that information and hopefully offer you guys some help.
All right. Peter, thank you very much for calling.
Okay. Thanks so much, gentlemen. Appreciate it.
No problem. Have a good day.
That was John Redowl and Arlo Ironcloud, co-hosts of the Wakalapi Chit Chat Show on KILI Radio in Porcupine, South Dakota. And earlier today, NASA went ahead with this mission outside the International Space Station that was supposed to make history.
How's it coming, Christina?
Good, I'm on the bridge.
I was going to drop a green hook.
I am at the IEA, a forward side.
The space agency scrapped its plan for its first ever all-female spacewalk earlier this week when astronaut Anne McClain realized the space station didn't have a spacesuit ready that would fit her. McClain needed a medium, so she stayed inside, and the spacewalk went ahead today with one man and one woman. Lindsay Aitchison is a former senior spacesuit engineer at NASA, and she now works on NASA's spacewalk strategy. Lindsay, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So there are two medium spacesuits on the space station, but the second one was not considered spaceworthy. What does that mean? What kind of work does it take to get one of these spacesuits ready?
What you have to understand about the way we design our spacesuits, they're a very modular system. And the reason we do that is that way we can have lots of different components so you can mix and match as our crews come up and down. They're all different sizes and shapes. And so having a modular system lets us have the most efficient set of options up there to size everybody appropriately. So when we say we have two medium suits on space station, what we're really talking about is we have two medium upper torsos. Mm. And so the upper torso is just one of about 12 different primary components that go into making your spacesuit. So what needed to happen to enable to have two medium huts is that you take one that's already attached to a life support system. That's the suit that Anne used on her EVA back on the 22nd.
Her first spacewalk.
Yes. To get the second one up and running, you would have had to actually change out the upper torso on a suit that was already attached to a portable life support system. And you need to make sure that everything is done in a very precise order to make sure there are no leaks and everything is safe to go for your EVA.
Now, Anne had gone out on a spacewalk at one point in a large, but she said she felt more comfortable in a medium. What's the danger of going out into space with a suit that doesn't fit just right?
So Anne actually has only done her first spacewalk, and that was in the medium. She did, however, do a lot of training in both the medium and the large size, and you never know which one is going to work out better for you until you're actually in space. Mm-hmm. The reason spacesuit fit is so important for you is that if you think about it, EVA is like any other piece of protective equipment that you're going to wear, whether you're a soldier wearing ballistic protection or you're a firefighter in all of your gear. If it doesn't fit you well, it's not going to protect you well, and that's really important because your spacesuit really is its own spacecraft. Everything that you have inside of the space station to protect you has to all be shrunk down and miniaturized perfectly to fit your body when you're outside doing your work.
Now, astronauts actually grow while they are in space because they're in a zero gravity sort of situation. How do you account for that when you're trying to fit these suits?
That's a great question. And we never actually know how much any one individual is going to grow until they get to space. They can grow up to 2 inches, and that's mostly in their spine. Hmm. So the way that we account for that in our spacesuit design is we have adjustability throughout the waist and the torso length. And so we make sure to have those sizing options available.
12 of NASA's 38 active astronauts are women, and I understand that the spacesuits actually don't come in a small size. Is there a plan to build more suits that will fit women?
That's actually been one of the drivers when we're looking at our next generation spacesuits. We're trying to be more accommodating of all sizes, not just females, but looking at the smaller end of the spectrum for males and females. And one of the things that we've been developing for next generation is actually an adjustable upper torso so that you can fit up to 2 different sizes within one unit. So it's much easier to fit a broader range of crew with less hardware. And that's actually something we've been testing out at our neutral buoyancy lab just this past year, in fact.
I'm fascinated how a human being can be out in space and comfortable using one of these suits. You know, you called it its own spaceship in a way. What do you think is the most interesting piece of technology inside that garment?
I think there are a lot of different technologies that I think are pretty cool. When I look toward future technologies, things that I find really cool, or we're looking at ways to incorporate going from having a checklist that's a physical book that's on your wrist to having a heads-up display inside of your spacesuit. So technology that's going to allow you to have an augmented reality as you're working on a specific section of a space station or even building up a lunar surface habitat.
So are you saying you could read information on your visor?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it'd be projected inside of your helmet as opposed to having to have a physical book. And then that way you can get a lot more interactive and have more information at your fingertips, as it were.
Lindsay, you are a woman and you work at NASA. What did you make of this week's news? Were you disappointed that history wasn't made?
I think it's definitely going to happen. There's going to be a time for women to take spacewalks together as an all-female crew. If you look at our most recent ASCAN class, 5 of the 11 selectees were women. I think that's great because everybody's going to have a role in space exploration as we go forward.
Which means you might have to start paying more attention to the suits that you have on the space station.
Absolutely, on station and as we go forward to explore other destinations.
That's Lindsay Aitchison, a former senior spacesuit engineer at NASA, now works on the agency's spacewalk strategy. Lindsay, thanks for your time.
Absolutely, thank you.
Every 4 years, when Americans vote in presidential elections, they're actually casting ballots for presidential electors. The Electoral College is unique. No other democratic country elects their head of state quite the way America does. And lately, it's been contentious. President Trump lost the popular vote to Hillary Clinton by a 2% margin, but won the election by 77 electoral votes. And 6 Democratic 2020 presidential candidates have recently expressed support for abolishing the Electoral College. Here's Democratic candidate Elizabeth Warren. She announced that proposal at a town hall in Jackson, Mississippi.
Well, my view is that every vote matters. And the way we can make that happen is that we can have national voting, and that means get rid of the Electoral College and everybody.
Scott Detrow is congressional correspondent for NPR. He joins us from Washington. Hi, Scott.
Hey there.
And let's go back to the beginning of the Electoral College. How did the founding fathers come up with this system, and what function was it supposed to serve?
Well, the thing that we often forget is that the idea of direct democracy and popular voting really wasn't baked into the United States at the early on. We were a republic, but the idea that people would go to the polls, let alone the entire country would go to the polls to select a president, just really wasn't on most of the founders' minds. So this was one of the many compromises that was made as they were putting together a federal government that really had to deal with more 13 different states interacting with each other than anything else. The idea of the popular vote playing a big role in determining the president really wasn't something that kicked in until over the course of the 19th century in waves. It really became the norm going forward.
And in recent years, we've had 2 presidents who have lost the popular vote, George W. Bush in 2000 and Donald Trump in 2016. Is the system now working the way it was intended?
Well, yeah, I mean, the fact that it's happened 2 times in recent memory, and both times the Democrats have been on the losing side of that split, has certainly made Democrats a lot more fired up about this issue than Republicans. Though, if you look at the polls, the idea of getting rid of the Electoral College is broadly popular. I don't think most people identify themselves as, well, I guess a few states are some exceptions, but, you know, people from Colorado or Iowa or California, I think by and large people view themselves as Americans and all living under the same government. Mm-hmm. So I think the idea of reassessing this is something that's picked up some steam.
Well, you mentioned it's more popular among Democrats than Republicans. Let's listen here to Fox News' Tucker Carlson responding to the proposal that we talked about from the 6 Democratic 2020 candidates for abolishing the Electoral College.
The Electoral College keeps the country from becoming a colony of California, Chicago, and New York. It demonstrates that America is a union of equal states, not a collection of provinces that revolve around a few powerful cities.
What about that idea, Scott, that abolishing the Electoral College would basically give the population centers of America all the political power?
You know, I'm not sure how much that holds up, because if you go state by state, each state has its own population centers as well, right? We're spread out in disproportionate numbers, and sometimes we're in clumps and sometimes we're not. And no matter where you're running, you're going to go focus where the bulk of the votes are.
But nobody's going to go to North and South Dakota or, you know, Rhode Island if they can get a lot more bang for their buck by campaigning in the big, big cities.
I guess that's true, and certainly the way that people run for president would change if this kicked in. But I think right now this is something that people are talking about. I think there's several more steps that need to happen for this to become close to reality.
What would it mean for the future of American elections if the presidency was decided by the popular vote?
Well, I think I think that reporters like me would spend a lot less time in Iowa and North Carolina and some of the key states. I mean, let's look at 2020, right? I think four or five states are going to determine it. Arizona, maybe, North Carolina, maybe, certainly Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. The Democrat especially is going to be in those states all the time. I think this would have an effect on local TV ads. I think this would have an effect on travel. But in terms of the message of the campaign, I don't think that would change too much because, you know, now that every event is live streamed and online as well as TV, it's not like candidates are tailoring their message in different ways as they campaign in different places in the general election.
Is there any chance that the Electoral College would be done away with?
Well, the big change would have to come through a constitutional amendment, but there's a workaround to that that actually has seen some momentum in recent weeks, and that's interesting. And that's this idea of a national compact that states pass laws, governors sign them into law, and they're basically saying we pledge to give our electoral votes to the national popular vote winner. This will kick in as soon as they have 270 electoral votes in their compact. Colorado and Delaware, in the last few weeks, signed new laws joining this compact. It's now up to 184 electoral votes, and I believe it's 14 states. So I think that would happen quicker than a constitutional amendment, given how fractured our current government is to get most basic things done, let alone amending the Constitution with the amount of support that would need.
That is Scott Detrow, NPR congressional correspondent. Scott, thanks.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.